Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even five times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Ben Bland, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 30th of November, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has chaired a meeting of the government's emergency committee shortly after two people were killed in London by a man with a knife. The president of the South American country of Suriname has been sentenced to 20 years in jail for the murder of 15 of his opponents in the 1980s. Police in Malta have released a businessman without charge after more than a week of questioning over the murder of an investigative journalist. Also in this podcast, No, don't adjust your set. We'll tell you why playing these sounds underwater could help to save coral reefs. But first, British police have shot dead a man in the centre of London after a number of people had been stabbed and seriously hurt. The authorities say it was a terrorist incident. Videos posted online showed passers-by on London Bridge wrestling with a man on the ground who was armed with a knife. One of the group managed to take the weapon off him. Several hours later, the city's police chief, Cressida Dick, had this to say.
It is with the heaviest of hearts that I have to inform you that, as well as the suspect who was shot dead by police, two of those injured in this attack in the London Bridge area have tragically lost their lives. The attack started at Fishmongers Hall in the City of London. If you are concerned about anyone who was there today, please try to contact them. And if you cannot, then get in touch with us.
Three other people were injured. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson held an emergency meeting at Downing Street on Friday night. He praised what he called the extraordinary bravery of members of the public who tackled the suspect. And he went on to say,
"This country will never be cowed or divided or intimidated by this sort of attack. And our values, our British values, will prevail."
The attack brought back memories of June 2017, when eight people were killed by a group of Islamists in exactly the same part of London. Angus Crawford followed events as they unfolded.
The alarm was raised just before 2 o'clock, after reports of a stabbing at a building near London Bridge. In a video posted on social media, a man dressed all in black can be seen lying on the ground, struggling with a passerby who's trying to restrain him. The attacker appears to have been disarmed, and another man holding a knife is backing away. Armed officers move in, shouting a warning. As the man on the ground tries to get to his feet, he's shot. Kirsten Jones was walking across the bridge when the incident happened.
People were starting to run and there was quite a lot of panic. And then we heard about two, three, maybe four very loud gunshots, and that's when the police started really screaming at people to get off the bridge and really run and try and get into the safest and nearest building with security.
Karen Bosch saw it from a passing bus.
And then the guy was lying on the floor. He then pulled his coat back, which showed that he had some sort of vest underneath, whether it's a stab vest or, you know, some sort of explosive vest, because the police then really quickly moved backwards away.
The London Ambulance Service declared a major incident at 3 p.m. and said there'd been a number of casualties. Later, the Met Police revealed that one man had been shot dead, and Assistant Commissioner Neil Basu said the incident was being treated as an act of terror.
Due to reports that the suspect may have had an explosive device, specialist officers also attended the scene, and wide cordons are in place to ensure there remains no further danger to the public. However, I can confirm at this time, we believe a device that was strapped to the body of the suspect is a hoax explosive device.
The London Mayor, Sadiq Khan, paid tribute to police officers and the passers-by who tried to help them.
I want to thank our brave emergency services who responded to today's horrific attack. Every day, they put their lives on the line for us, running towards danger in order to keep us safe. I would also like to thank members of the public who risked their own safety this afternoon. They are the best of us.
At this stage, it's being treated as an isolated incident, and police are not thought to be looking for anyone else in connection with the attack.
Angus Crawford. And as we recorded this podcast, we heard more details about how the incident began and who the attacker was from our reporter, Andy Moore.
Police tell us the incident started at 13:58 in Fishmongers Hall, which is a very grand livery hall just north of London Bridge. We now know that there was an event there involving staff and students from Cambridge University and former prisoners. One young woman was stabbed in that building. At least one young woman was stabbed there. And then there was an altercation, a fight that spread to the street outside. We know that members of the public and people who were attending that meeting tried to fight the knifeman. There was almost a rugby scrum, it was described as. And then armed police turned up, and within 5 minutes, they shot and killed the knifeman. And we're just, in the last few minutes, getting a few more details from the Press Association, the agency here in the UK, that the knife attacker was known to police and had connections to terror groups. We know he was a former prisoner. I talked about that that meeting involving university staff and former prisoners. So that would suggest he was attending that meeting as a former prisoner. And it seems now that he was on the radar of the police.
Andy Moore. Next to the Netherlands, and the authorities there say they are keeping an open mind over whether a stabbing attack inside a department store in The Hague on Friday evening was terror-related. At least three people were injured. Dutch police say they're searching for a man who they believe may be behind the attack. Lewis Vaughan Jones spoke to a student, Sylvia Gerardi, who was close to the area where the stabbings took place.
I just saw a lot of people running and screaming, and they didn't know anything, of course.
That's a pretty frightening situation, and you obviously took yourself away to safety.
Yeah. I went, like, a bit further from the scene, and no one noticed nothing, like, anything there, so it was pretty safe space there. But then police start coming, like, dozens, like, firefighters and ambulances. Yeah, and they blocked the street with some red and white tape.
And did you get any information at all from the police when you were down there about what was happening?
No, police was just saying go away.
And have you got, obviously, were you alone at the time, or were you with people? Why were you there?
I was alone. I just said bye to some friends. And I was there for shopping, of course. It was Black Friday.
Sylvia Gerardi, a student in The Hague. A court in the South American country of Suriname has sentenced President Daisa Bautista to 20 years in prison for the murder of 15 political opponents in 1982. Mr. Bautista is in China on an official visit and will have 2 weeks to appeal against the conviction. He has previously denied the accusations. Leonardo Rocha reports.
The court found him guilty of planning and ordering the extrajudicial execution of 15 political prisoners in Suriname 17 years ago. The December murders, as the incident became known, led to international condemnation. Among the victims were lawyers, union leaders and journalists. Mr. Bautista said in the past that they were shot while trying to escape a colonial-era fortress in the capital, Paramaribo. Six of the people accused of involvement have already died since the trial began 12 years ago.
Leonardo Rocha. protesters in Malta held another demonstration on Friday night, renewing their calls for Prime Minister Joseph Muscat to resign. His government has come under huge pressure in recent days in connection with the killing 2 years ago of the investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. On Friday, a prominent businessman, Jorgen Fenech, was released after he was questioned about the murder. Our Europe correspondent Damian Grammaticus spent Friday night in Valletta amid the protests.
I'm right in the heart of Malta in Valletta. We're on a hill overlooking the harbour, the historic harbour on this Mediterranean island. In front of me is a castle and then the baroque front of the Prime Minister's office. This beautiful historic building, floodlit, there's a Christmas tree there. And then that crowd you can probably hear now. These are the anti-corruption protesters, the supporters of Daphne Caruana Galizia, the murdered journalist. They're calling for the Prime Minister's resignation, for a clean-up of corruption. That's what those speeches are about. And what they really want to see, they say, is the murder investigation extend all the way, and they believe, to the sort of top political echelons of government, that there needs to be accountability there, and the Prime Minister, they think, should step aside because they believe that he has been shielding people near the top.
And it seems like pressure has been intensifying on the Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, to resign. Why this intensification now?
Yes, it absolutely has been. So let me take you through very quickly. So Daphne Caruana Galizia was assassinated in a car bombing 2 years ago, blown up. She had been writing extensively about corruption and cronyism at the highest levels, naming people who were cabinet ministers, who the Prime Minister's chief of staff, top business people. Investigations in that have been very slow, but in the last few days, a whistleblower came out. This very rich businessman, Jorgen Fenech, was arrested. He's been taken in by police, released again on bail, but he has also been threatening to name top political figures. So two cabinet ministers resigned, the Prime Minister's chief of staff resigned, and at the minute, the Prime Minister has been holding on, saying that he wants to stay in office and oversee this investigation. But the protesters here, what they believe is that the Prime Minister himself is too closely implicated, that all those around him are implicated in this as well, and that they believe he has to move for a full investigation to be able to go ahead, and that's what they're calling for.
Damian Grammaticus in Malta. Thursday was one of the bloodiest days in Iraq since anti-government protests began nearly 2 months ago. Security forces killed more than 40 demonstrators in three cities, Baghdad, Najaf and Nasiriyah. The country's prime minister, Adel Abdel-Mahdi, has now said he will resign after Iraq's most senior Shia cleric, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, delivered this message through a spokesman.
The parliament from which this current government is drawn is asked to reconsider its choice in this regard and act according to Iraq's interest and preserve the blood of its children to prevent the country from slipping into violence, chaos and destruction.
But this Baghdad protester said he wanted the whole administration to follow Mr. Mahdi's lead and quit.
The resignation of Prime Minister Adel Abdel-Mahdi is the start of the reform, and our revolution is continuing until we achieve all our demands. All must leave, the entire government should leave, because they are responsible for the bloodshed.
I asked the BBC's Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen if the Prime Minister's resignation was inevitable after the Ayatollah's intervention.
Yes, it was. Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani doesn't talk a great deal, but when he talks, people listen. He's the top Shia cleric in the country and he's the most influential voice as well. So if he says there needs to be some change at the top, well, some change at the top probably will happen. Now, the question is whether it will be the start of something, which demonstrators hope, or whether the Prime Minister is being offered up as a token sacrifice to the people on the streets.
And will the Prime Minister's resignation be enough for the protesters who've been out on the streets for weeks now?
I think it'll be enough if it leads to some reforms. They want new electoral laws, they want new elections. Some of them want essentially root and branch reform, sweeping away the entire sectarian-based system that's there in Iraq that was set up after the invasion of 2003. you know, they're fed up with the way their lives have gone. They're fed up that in a country with massive oil reserves, way too many people don't have jobs, are impoverished, live off very little money. They can't rely on the electricity supplies, which is really significant in the summer in a country where temperatures regularly get up to 50 plus. You know, they can't even run a fan, that sort of thing. And so people are fed up. And a lot of this as well is being driven by younger people, the under 30s, more than 60% of the population, who just, they're pretty desperate. I think they don't, they're risking going out on the streets where they might get shot and killed because they feel they don't have any other choices. Because also, don't forget, with satellite TV and social media, you can't close a country down like used to be the case. People can see how others live and they think, well, why do we have to live like this? But how the process goes that gives them the reforms that they want, now that's a different matter, and that's a long and hard road that may not end well either.
Jeremy Bowen. Here's news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Kalki Kekla. I'm a Bollywood actor and, of course, a podcast presenter. And I'm back for another season of My Indian Life. For our second season, I've been traveling all over this huge country.
Everything came crashing down because this was the only thing we had left in Kashmir. I felt like I didn't belong in Delhi.
Talking to a wide range of people who all have something to say.
There is this old belief that anybody who's born with a genetic condition is a result of sin or a result of something that happened in your life in the past, and that's why there's a stigma attached to it.
All in the company of some really inspiring young Indians.
I think happiness is a mindset, not just an emotion. I can decide to be happy or I can decide to be sad.
That's Kalki presents My Indian Life from the BBC World Service.
This music is rogue. It really represents what's going on the ground level over here.
Just search for My Indian Life wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to France. Climate activists staged a protest in a shopping centre in Paris on Friday, so-called Black Friday, as the American tradition spreads across Europe, promising a long weekend of sales and reduced prices. Caliré, who's an activist from the Youth for Climate Association, said it was a day when many people bought things they didn't need.
Today is Black Friday. It's pushing people to overspend. This overconsumption draws from our planet and draws resources which are often compulsive purchases and which are useless.
There was a sit-in at Amazon's headquarters in France, as well as demonstrations in other French cities. Our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, told me how people were starting to react against the recent shopping phenomenon.
Black Friday didn't exist in France until a couple of years ago. I remember when it first arrived, I don't know, 2014, 2015, people didn't know what on earth it was. But gradually and rapidly, it's taken hold and become part of the annual system, the commercial system. And now it's here and very present, and it's where a lot of people do their shopping and has an enormous amount of online activity and so on. And sort of contemporaneously, the opposition has grown, because from the left, from the political left, the environmentalist left, there is you know, a feeling that this whole thing is an American import, which really has no place in French society, and that it's an encouragement to hyper-consumerism. And they've chosen this year to go public with this in a way that they haven't done before, bringing together those two strands, the environmental strand and the kind of left-wing anti-consumerist strand.
And we've seen quite a few demonstrations at grassroots level opposing it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, nothing sort of that's brought the country to a halt, but I mean, the stuff that's been well publicised, which is the main point of it, that the headquarters of Amazon and a number of depots of Amazon have been, well, blockaded is too strong a word, but, you know, there have been protests outside them which have been disrupted by police and so on. Amazon's been selected because for these activists, it is the kind of epitome of the new company which is A, for them encouraging this excessive consumerism as they see it, and on the other hand, according into their lights, you know, breaking all sorts of environmentalist good practice.
Have they responded to the protests that were targeted?
Yeah, they have. I mean, they have been quite vigorous in rebutting the charges against them. They point out that they say there's a lot of misinformation about what they do. They say they are in the forefront of good practice in encouraging reforestation, in encouraging alternative methods of packaging and so on. They talk about the amount of employment they're providing in France. And, you know, more generally, they make the point, which is made by everyone who's involved in e-commerce, which is that, they have fleets of vehicles taking stuff to deliver to people. But that, for them, is better and more environmentally friendly than each individual driving his or her car to a shop to get the same product.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Tributes have been paid to one of the world's leading climbers who has fallen to his death in Mexico. Brad Gobright, a 31-year-old American, was descending a sheer rock face with another climber when both men fell. His companion survived. Here's Guy Pitt.
Brad Gobright was best known for climbing without using ropes, a practice known as free soloing. He also held the record for the fastest ascent of one of the hardest routes on El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. He died climbing in the Potrero Chico Range in the northern Mexican state of Nuevo León. Witnesses say the accident happened as he was abseiling back down a sheer face with another climber, Aidan Jacobson. They both fell, but while Mr. Jacobson landed on a ledge and survived, Mr. Gobright dropped 1,000 feet to his death. Other climbers have paid tribute to the dead man, one saying he had a magic about him on the rock.
Now, let's talk about CVs or resumes and honesty. Now, I wouldn't for a moment suggest that you don't owe your career to your own achievements, but in an increasingly crowded environment, how do you ensure that your CV stands out from the crowd, yet stays the right side of the truth? Sasha Twining delved into the world of CVs.
It's a tricky moral maze. Where do you draw the line between enhancing your CV or resume to make sure you stand out and get the job and telling a downright lie? Is it acceptable to exaggerate your experience to get through to the interview stage? How do employers sort through the truths and exaggerations to get the best candidate? And what about modern tech and the role the resume robot is starting to play? First, a lesson in what happens when it all goes very wrong, very publicly.
A senior Trump official has resigned under pressure. Mina Chang was accused of lying on her resume in order to get her job at the State Department. She's even accused of faking a Time magazine cover. What? She's now resigned, although she calls the allegations against her completely false.
Yahoo's CEO is suddenly out of a job. Scott Thompson was kicked out on Sunday. The move comes shortly after a disgruntled shareholder revealed that Thompson's biography on the company's website listed a degree that Thompson never received.
Not the sort of career advancement anyone would want. Su Ping Chan is producing this piece with me today. This is fascinating.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of people talking, as I found out when we put a post on the BBC LinkedIn page and we asked people, A, have they lied on their CVs or have they found their employees lying in the first place? And we got a big response.
Oh, well, that one from Richard.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's not lying, he says. It's just being creative with the truth.
And there's a reply there with a smiley face that says, creative indeed. Maybe we need to get an expert opinion on this because there's very much two sides to that story from those responses. So who have we got?
So first, it's Kate Grusing. So she is managing director and founder of Sapphire Partners. They were actually involved in trying to find the next governor of the Bank of England, so one of the country's top jobs. Secondly, Lee McQueen. So now he runs the Raw Talent Academy, but 10 years ago he was famous, or perhaps infamous, for something else.
I won The Apprentice in 2008 in the UK.
And for our listeners in America, this is the same The Apprentice that, of course, the now very own President Trump,
Donald Trump is, for sure,
is associated with. Yes, you won it, but there was a particular moment in that last episode. Would you mind if we played it to you?
To be fair, it shapes who you are. So, yeah, absolutely, go for it. Remind the listeners that I made a bit of a big bump in the road, shall we say.
You were doing a degree, were you? Or?
No. Unfortunately for me, my exam results, etc., were never good enough to do a degree.
Okay.
When I was a training catering manager, they put me through to a professional qualification in catering. I was there for 2 years.
You sure it was 2 years?
As far as I'm aware, it was 2 years, yes.
Was it? The university's actually dropped me a line here, confirming you're only there 4 months.
Really? Oh, OK. Well, then it was 4 months then.
Still quite uncomfortable, to even though that was, what, 11 years ago, to hear that. But again, I'm not here to justify. I think, like I said before, it shapes who you are. And if it wasn't for that moment, I probably wouldn't have set my business up.
Kate, you were listening to that, the grilling by Lord Sugar aide Borden Katchuk. Do you call universities? Do you check up on people?
It depends on the role. Absolutely. And if there's a gap on the CV, I want to understand why.
So what about tech? In a world increasingly driven by computer learning and artificial intelligence, could AI play a role in getting your resume right or weeding out the dishonest ones?
Hello, my name is Dean Sadler and I'm the founder and CEO of Tripad.
Dean's company, in simple terms, uses tech and AI to sift through applications and match them to keywords picked by potential employers. I got him to show me how it works.
So this is one of our products, and what I've done is I've just logged in as a recruiter, and I've just searched for the term finance, and it's sifted through the individuals, looked at their profiles, and identified 8 candidates that have finance as a core capability.
So you could do this with thousands of candidates immediately?
So we can search up to 2 million within a second. I mean, this is rapid technology.
You work with some of the really big names in the industry. Do you foresee a day where one of those will come to you and say, actually, we don't want the human interaction anymore, we need to employ 100 new office workers, and actually it is all done through AI and tech?
No, I can't see that in my lifetime right now. Although AI and machine learning has come a long way in the last 5 years, I think there's still a substantial way to go to make that reality. And even then, I don't think people would be comfortable with that.
That report by Sasha Twining. Now, here's one way to fool fish. Well, fool anyone, frankly, at the sounds of a healthy coral reef, which researchers have been playing through loudspeakers near abandoned or degraded patches of reefs to try to lure fish towards them and give the reefs a chance to flourish. And it appears they've been having some success. James Kumarasamy spoke to Dr. Steve Simpson, a professor of marine biology and global change at Exeter University here in the UK, who co-authored the research.
Tragically, one of my PhD students, Tim Gordon, a superb marine biologist, started his PhD at the time that the Great Barrier Reef got hit by a heat wave. Within about 3 weeks, the whole reef got killed by extreme warm waters. It was full of seaweed rather than fish. The corals were dead. And when we started listening to this reef, it was almost silent. So we thought, well, first of all, what does that mean for fish finding their way home? And played back recordings of the new dead Great Barrier Reef, and hardly any fish showed up at our little reefs. But then when we played back our historic recordings from when the reef was in good condition, we could still call these new baby fish into the habitat. And we took these historic recordings from only 6 years ago and played them back to some of the most degraded coral reef habitats. And sure enough, we could call the fish into these degraded habitats. And by doing this for 6 weeks, we realized we could rebuild the community of fish that live there. And those fish are ultimately critical for the reef to recover.
How's that?
A lot of coral reef fish are herbivores, so they eat plants. And when a coral reef is degraded by bleaching, starts to die, quite quickly seaweed overgrows the corals. And these herbivores are essential for cleaning off the dead coral surfaces so that the new corals have space to grow.
What is the plan then, to have bunches of speakers around the reef?
What we are now anticipating is that by working with technologists, we can create sound systems which can be powered by solar energy. So during the day in the tropics, obviously, there's a lot of sunlight. Harvest that, recharge your batteries, and then during the nighttime, play back the sounds of healthy habitat to draw in the next generation to give it a chance to recover.
And will the fish necessarily stay, or might they think they've been rather hoodwinked when they get back and find it's not a healthy reef after all?
So in a way, they have been hoodwinked. But what we're doing really is making an environment that the fish would never find attractive again, making it somewhere that they will come and make their home. Now, actually, when fish settle onto reefs, they don't need a full, healthy coral reef. They need somewhere to hide. And in a degraded habitat, there's still plenty of hiding places. And then with a bit of herbivore action on that reef as those fish start to grow up, the corals will start to grow back and we'll start to see that healthy community come back.
And how does that fit into the bigger picture of trying to save or regenerate these coral reefs?
I mean, that's a critical question. What we've been describing really in many ways is a sticking plaster for the reefs for the future. It was a heat wave that was very unusual for the Northern Great Barrier Reef that really wiped out most of the corals. So we clearly need to be addressing climate change over the next 20, 50, 100 years so that the reefs really are able to be living for centuries to come.
Dr. Steve Simpson there, a professor of marine biology and global change at Exeter University in southern England. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast for you later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Ben Bland. Until the next time, goodbye.